Welcome once again, dear listeners, to another episode of Aeronauts. My name is Eldrick, and again, together with me, is Boss and Vincent. The title of today's episode is Critical Phases of Flight. So guys, how have you been for the past week?
So far, my week has been as usual, no flights, nothing. Managed to play a tournament and yeah, tomorrow I'll be flying off, so that's why hence the recording has to be done early.
And myself, I haven't been doing much other than gardening and baking. I made cookies and cake today, and yesterday I was planting bird's eye chilies, mint, garlic, pumpkin. Yeah, I'm keeping myself occupied just by planting new things. Keeping myself occupied. How about you, Ulrich? What were you doing?
For me, I just doing some job hunting and just meeting up with friends. That's most of it. I'm going to start off with the introduction of the critical phases of flight. So critical phases of flight is the takeoff run, the takeoff flight path, the final approach, the missed approach, and also the landing part of the flight. And it is which most of the aircraft accidents occur. And because the aircraft is still low to the ground, and it does not have enough altitude or time to recover from a mistake. Hence, the critical phases of flight is mostly on the takeoff run and the landing part of the flight. So, guys, what do you know or understand about the critical phases of flight?
Too low terrain, pull up, landing gear. Yeah, basically that's when I give such readouts. Basically, you are closer to the ground and anything can happen, although it, no matter how routinal it could be, anything can happen. So because you're closer to the ground, so it's very crucial that we are safe from departure all the way to landing. In that sense, so yeah, it is very critical points of time. So basically, we will not be, I would say, gossiping or you know, like cracking jokes or whatever. We will be totally concentrating on this particular times, in other words.
Okay, so how about you, Vincent? What do you understand about critical phases of flight?
Basically, it's just as what you've explained and what Boss has just said. So you know, most accidents actually occur during all these phases, and the only way to avoid all these things is actually to increase your situational awareness, because when your situation awareness actually increases, then in a way you actually, you know, you're not fixated to something else which is not important during this phase of flight.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you think, is it so important for us flight crews to to know the importance of this critical phase of flight, like in training wise?
Both airlines and also the both airlines and so the manufacturer of the aircraft will actually have provide checklists, you know, during those critical phases of flight. For example, like before start checklist, after start checklist, before takeoff, after takeoff, to name a few. So this checklist actually tells you that the workload is very high during this period of flight, you know. So therefore, checklist is there to actually protect flight crew from skipping the important tasks. During this important time, you refer to the checklist, you won't go wrong. So in a way, you're actually minimizing accidents and incidents from occurring.
Okay. All right. So how about you, Boss?
Research show that 83% of accidents occur during stages, this critical phases of flight, lah. So it is important that we have good SA. In other words, like what Vincent mentioned was situational awareness. So one way is, as what mentioned by Vincent, was checklists. The other one is, it's not only written in our SOPs as well as, it's not only written in SOPs. However, like what mentioned earlier, also manufacturers and companies, so they actually clearly state in our operating handbooks stating that no any, there's a thing called sterile cockpit that you're supposed to have. So yeah, sterile cockpit is basically a point of time where, sorry, a point of duration where no unnecessary talk, strictly concentrating on flying, and both pilots must be concentrating. That is why there will be always a counter check whenever we say so. Like in my work of operations, whenever we pass 2,000 feet on the approach, pilot flying mentions that 2,000 feet no flags. The other guy, the pilot monitoring will say check. And if one pilot says the pilot monitoring mentions 1,000 feet stabilized, the pilot flying will say continue. So that is all. That is what we call coordination, and it ensures safety is being safety standards is being maintained by within by two people. So it is very critical because again you're closer to the ground, you're closer to the terrain where anything can happen. So it's very critical.
May I add on to that? Actually, there's this civil aviation regulation that was set by the FAA, I think. We call it CAR, C-A-R. So CAR 121.503, it says that the certified holder shall not require any of crew member to perform any task during critical phases of flight, except those duties required for the safe operation of the airplane. The critical phases of flight referred are pushback, taxi, takeoff, approach, and landing. And also any other airport air operations conducted below 10,000 feet, except in cruise flights. So basically, even the authorities have been saying, you know, these are the critical phases of flight, and you know anything below 10,000 feet, it's considered a critical phase. That's why even seatbelts, you know, we release seatbelt, you know, above 10,000 feet, not anything below 10,000 feet.
From what I understand, above 10,000 feet is for jet operations stuff. From my friends from the turboprop, I was told that above minimum safe altitude onwards, they will actually release seatbelts because their highest flight also is about, 14,000, 15,000 feet. So that is why they release it earlier for service reasons, just for information.
Okay. Like what you guys have said about aircraft checklist, pre-takeoff checklist, and also the sterile cockpit situation, there have been a few incidents on takeoff where the crews forgot to extend the flaps. That is one of the crucial tasks for the takeoff run because if not, the aircraft do not have enough lift to get off the ground to get airborne in a short distance, and also the aircraft just overrun the runway and crash. So yeah, that's very important.
And also
for the sterile cockpit situation, also there's one incident where the pilots are so distracted with the cabin crew, I think, and they forgot also forget to extend the flaps. That's also one of the reasons.
That is why they actually included it in the new checklist before departure or before takeoff. One of the checklists mentions that you have to check a flap set. So it comes back to that previous conversation where we had about the Swiss cheese model, where it's to filter out any sort of loopholes that is bound to have been overseen. So the checklist is, well, it's the final guard from you to end up in such a problem. So yes, I think ever since, even before that particular time or so, we have already been introduced that checklist for the flaps and all those things.
Yep, very true. But instead, nowadays, they still manage to forget the very vital part for takeoff. So it still has loopholes in it. So like nowadays, latest generation aircraft, like the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, they have electronic checklist.
Because like, let's say your flaps is not up, and there will actually be a red indicator that's green, right, saying it's not complete. That kind of thing, isn't it?
If I'm not mistaken, the Airbuses and also
Airbus is the first.
Airbuses and also the my friend from the turboprops also, they said that it'll actually indicate whether you have completed the checklist or not. I'm not sure about the Boeings have introduced it yet or not, but the Airbuses, yes, I'm aware about that.
Mm, it's a very good design where it safeguards mistakes like I mentioned before this. So yeah, it's a very good design. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the approach and landing is one of the highest risk phases of flight, accounting for over 50% of all accidents for aviation. Estimated 80% of all plane crashes happen during the first 3 minutes or 8 minutes prior to landing. Why is it so?
Okay, as mentioned by you earlier, first 3 minutes of departure and 8 minutes of arrival. We are very close to terrain, and as mentioned by you, inadequate height and inadequate speed, a lot can happen. For our conversation again on our previous episode about Sally, at 2800, he encountered a dual engine failure, and then the checklist mentioned something like he must have about 300 knots of speed when he was actually climbing at about 280 or 150 knots of climb rate, which is insufficient for him to regenerate thrust, and hence the result of actually having the Hudson River miracle, in other words. So, and not to take into factor about environmental, like animals, there's also other environmental
causes.
Yes, thank you. Environmental causes such as weather and unexpected disturbances from another aircraft, for that matter, and lack of concentration. So yeah, it's very critical. Not only you're damaging the particular aircraft, you're damaging other people's property at the same time. So yeah.
Got nothing to add on, boss. Boss has actually covered.
Okay, thanks.
Sterile cockpit violations is one of the contributing factors to accidents that happen during takeoff and landings, and is caused by distracted or inattentive pilots. Why is it so?
Like you said, critical phases of flight. These are the phases that where you know the workload is very high during all this period. So when there is an extra interference, let's say from someone else who doesn't know about the rules and regulation or the SOP that is set by the airlines itself. So in a way, when let's say they, for example, let's say you are, let me give you an easy example. Let's say you're driving a car, and then your kid actually you know talk to you and then distract you with things like, okay, is that or mom, let's see my phone, you know, for a while, you know, there's something I need to show you. So in a way, you actually lost your situational awareness. That's one of the reasons I would.
My explanation will be similar to Vincent's. It's something like this. I'm sure many of us have a habit of answering phone calls while we are driving. Are we concentrating on driving, or are we on autopilot when we are driving, when we are on a conversation with someone? Now, that is what you call situational awareness. We will be driving the car, yes, but is our concentration on the phone call or while driving? Because most of the time, you will be actually on autopilot. I mean, it's second nature that we know what to do, but subconsciously, we are actually driving the car. We are not consciously driving the car. So, yeah, that is why to avoid such incidents happening, we have a sterile cockpit. So, unnecessary conversations shall be left on ground or above 10,000 feet to ensure that your full concentration is on landing the plane and departing the plane very safely and not subconsciously flying.
Control flight into terrain is one of the causes of approach and landing phases of flight. Why is it so?
CFIT, for now, there are three incidents that I could remember of control CFIT or control flight into terrain that I could think of. One of it was Korean Air, where they were supposed to be landing in Guam and then they crashed the plane. That one is one because they were not really aware. Their situational awareness was not very good. So yeah, they did that particular incident. And then the other one that I could think of is actually Japan Airlines crashing into their mountains. I'm not really well aware about what was it all about, but it was another control flight into terrain kind of situation. But how about you, Vincent?
Like we have already mentioned a lot of times, a situation awareness. So many, many severe accidents actually occur because of loss of situation awareness. Sometimes the lack of familiarity with the airport itself could also actually cause incidents such as, you know, like this. Because when you're not familiar with a place, and if there's weather, additional weather into it, then, you know.
Okay, one of the criteria has been created to assist in reducing the risk of accidents in the approach and landing phase of flight. That is a stabilized approach criteria. How does that help minimize the accidents in this circumstance?
For a stabilized approach criteria, for all I know, Boeing has a few recommendations. If one of those criteria are not met,
you have to do a go around.
Correct. The only way to do it is just to do a go around. In some cases, there are actually people who actually still want to try their luck and continue the approach. In a way, it goes back to also the SA and a bit of knowledge here. So if you don't know what the stabilized approach criteria, you would not be able to know when do you need to do a go around and when you can actually continue the flight. That's the reason the stabilized approach criteria is there.
Yeah, but for me, basically, I would say stabilization approach is to ensure that you're stabilized when you're arriving or departing. I mean, on arriving last, you're talking about stabilization approach. If you're not stable, so chances for us to be going to unsafe situations is very, very high, which can cost lives, you see. So, yeah, that's all I can say.
Yeah, so captain, or you can say also sometimes first officer who have that macho character where they think they can handle an unstabilized approach. So what do you guys think? Should you tell him, you know, to go around or you just see how it goes?
This will actually fall into the crew resource management area in CRM. But sometimes when both the pilots are, you know, they have flown a few sectors back and forth and then maybe that is their very last flight into the, you know, to the destination. So in a way fatigue has already played a role into it. Sometimes they just what they want is to just land the plane and, you know, get the job done. So yeah, that is also one of those reasons.
One of my working colleagues actually experienced Vincent said. It's actually called a get there itis kind of behavior, where they completed a few sectors and then they put themselves in very unstable arrivals, unstable approaches. And I would say the power distance between both of them was actually really bad. So even when the co-pilot would like to say something to the captain, also with the arrogance of the captain, the FO, actually not to say arrogance, but the FO believed that the captain with his knowledge and this arrogance should be able to land the aircraft safely. However, it ended up in an incident which left him traumatized actually. So in short, if it ain't stabilized, even for not only for myself but for everybody, if it's not stabilized, be it arrogance or seniority or whatever, go around is a go around.
Yeah.
And if the captain refuses, make it very clear in the flight recorder, because everything is recorded, that you are proceeding with this. You're agreeing with this flight with protest. So that is to ensure that you have done your part of your job. And if anything happens, at the end of the day, captain is still held responsible for what has happened.
Yeah, but there is also, if you really have got no choice and you really think the aircraft is in grave danger,
you can take control.
Correct. The FO can actually, you know, take over control.
So that is why procedures, basically being a pilot is very disciplined and very routine also. You have to do your best to ensure you use proper and correct phraseologies to ensure that both people are at the same page, regardless of power distance being very bad. And speaking of power distance, I'm curious, I'm sure that you all might be wondering what is actually power distance. It's actually the invisible distance between ranks, where a captain and a co-pilot are in different ranks. So sometimes co-pilot would be hesitant to actually talk to the captain because believing that the captain is much more experienced. And at times, captain talk over the co-pilot because they are juniors and they are naive in certain things. So this is what power distance comes about. And then a point where captains and co-pilots are unable to actually talk to each other because of them. So it creates a very unusual, awkward cockpit. That is sterile cockpit, but this is even more worse. You'll feel very uneasy sitting next to the guy next to you.
But there is also actually a different kind of power distance. One where, you know, when the captain acts like a brother to you, you know, he's like very good friend to you on the cockpit. That could actually also be a factor.
Yes. Yeah. Power distance should be on a medium ground in the sense where I give you face, but at the same time, I have to put my foot down and say, look here, this is your job, you should do what you're supposed to do.
In short, just stick to your SOP and also use all the standard phraseology. That's all.
Yes. It's good to have a friendly captain, but at the same time, not too friendly to a point where the co-pilot or anyone for that matter to climb on top of the captain's head and build an apartment out of it. So, you know? So that is the power distance that we are talking about. That is the extreme, and then that is too lenient. So you have to be in the middle ground, in order to ensure safety.
But like you said about power distancing, there's an example of an incident. I think by a Korean Air 747, after departure, they crashed straight into the ground because their captain had an unreadable artificial horizon, and he didn't notice anything. So his co-pilot told him about the problem that he's overbanking the aircraft, but he didn't listen, like you said, power distancing. So but the first officer didn't voice out.
Basically, my personal opinion is that even myself also, I'm not going to say that it's not going to happen to me. Along, maybe in the future, there will be one, two incidents where I will think that I know better than you. So it'll sort of, when I have such a behavior, it comes with arrogance. I hope I don't have this one, but I'm sure that I might one day actually accidentally drop into it, into that particular label. So I better, I think being human, it's sort of like, just because I know better, you should keep quiet kind of situation may arise. It's just that you have to remember that power distance have to be at its middle ground, lah. It's not supposed to be, oh, just because I'm senior, I know everything, and, you know, oh, no worries, bro, everything is okay, and then, you know, people climb on my head.
There is also a reason why all airlines are now actually implementing this CRM class every year, yearly renewal kind of thing. No, it's to emphasize to all their crews, you know, about what they should do and what they should not be doing, you know, when it comes to things like that.
True. Okay, on to the accident scenarios. Okay, for Turkish Flight 1951 introduction, it was a passenger flight that crashed during landing at Amsterdam Schiphol Airport, Netherlands, on 25th February 2009, resulting in the deaths of 9 passengers and crew, including all 3 pilots. So, according to the situation, how does it snowball into a crash? What factors played in this scenario, like example, the radio altimeter failure?
I wouldn't say it's a snowball effect. I would say it's a domino effect where a lot of things actually occurred. Things have been answered. It was a training flight. it was a chain reaction that was due to happen. So, like, if you noticed in the report, it mentioned something like they had a radio altimeter failure. Sorry, not failure, radio altimeter error. And it was not reported to the flight crew. And it was a training flight. So it was a line training captain was doing a check with the co-pilot, and there was a safety pilot on board. The proper the go-around procedure also was not carried out properly, which is why it actually ended up in such a result. So, yeah, this is the things that I managed to catch.
Same as what I've read from the report based on what Paul said. Here, point out a few couple more things. You know, the aircraft actually passed 1,000 feet above height, and then the approach was actually not stabilized. In a way, like we have mentioned, the stabilized approach criteria, the approach was already not stabilized, so the crew should have actually initiated the go-around, which they did not. And then at the same time, the radio altimeter system errored. The error actually also increased the workload of the flight crew. If I'm not mistaken, eventually it caused the flight crew to actually do the landing checklist a bit later than what they were supposed to do. In accordance to the Turkish airline SOP, where you are supposed to abort the approach at 1,000 feet if your aircraft isn't stabilized. So all these things actually resulted in that crash. So if the crew had realized something was wrong, they had go around and continue. I mean, the crash could have been avoided. And also, if I'm not mistaken, there were indications in the cockpit, but the crew did not notice the decrease in airspeed until the approach to stall has came up. I mean, the flight crew's workload has already been increased by then. Eventually, led on to our main topic here, the critical phases of flight.
Yeah. Like what you said, if they had noticed the radio altimeter error on the landing phase, they would have prevented the crash, I mean, earlier on. But the final safeguard of this approach as well, they should have recovered the aircraft to safety and go around, like as what you said. So this is a fact because there's no one cause of the accident. So yeah, it's like a snowball effect, or like what boss said, a domino effect.
If you actually notice, all of us for that matter, when we are doing line training, the captain has much more extra workload compared to average line pilots. Have you noticed or not?
Oh, of course.
I ever wonder why?
Because you are the extra baggage for them, bro.
Yes. You see, normally when we are flying two-man crew, one person is concentrating on the other is concentrating on the other. So both pilots are actually keeping on each other's toes. This one, training line pilot captains, they are actually training you and they are flying the plane at the same time. So their concentration is divided into three. One, I have to train you. Two, I have to monitor myself. Three, I have to monitor you at the same time. Okay. Yeah.
That's why there will be an extra crew on board who is, you know, at the back there monitoring.
Yes. So if at all anything happens, the third person is there behind. The safety pilot is there to ensure the safety of the flight. However, for this particular case, because everything happened too fast, the safety pilot did highlight a few things. However, they were not stabilized. They should have commenced a go around. However, they didn't. And this is the result of their actions. All three of the crew lost their lives, plus additional passengers' lives also were lost at the same time.
I mean, there's also another effect. The ATC cleared them for high-end approach because they need to intercept the glide slope from above, so they were high and fast. They were rushing the descent and a lot of things were happening during that phase. So that's why a lot of distractions as well. And the third pilot also was distracted with their situation. So at the end, they didn't have enough time to recover the aircraft, and yeah, that's why the aircraft crashed. Yeah. Okay, so on to the second incident. Asiana Airlines Flight 214 was a scheduled Trans-Pacific passenger flight from Incheon International Airport near Seoul, South Korea, to San Francisco International Airport in the United States. On the morning of July 6, 2013, the Boeing 777 crashed on final approach into San Francisco International Airport. So, guys, what do you think about the accident? Is the CRM involved, or poor CRM perhaps contributed to the crash?
Based on the report that I have, the probable cause of the accident was actually the flight crew's failure to monitor and maintain minimum safe airspeed during the final approach. So
I see.
That's part of it. So it resulted in a deviation below the glide path and eventually impact with the rain. But there is a few contributing factors to this situation, you know, where it says that the inconsistency in the aircraft's automation logic, the crew over relied on the automation. So the crew actually thought that auto throttle was helping them maintaining the airspeed. And the auto throttle logic that unexpectedly disabled the aircraft's minimum airspeed. What the flight crew failed to notice is that the auto throttle actually is not helping the aircraft maintain the airspeed. What they should have done is just to disengage the auto throttle and, you know, fly the aircraft manually. During these critical phases of flight, sometimes automation helps you to reduce the workload, but that does not entirely allow you to, you know, forego that workload. So in this case, this is what happened. Basically, it's an over-reliance on the automation, which caused the accident to actually happen.
I guess it's human nature to rely autopilot a lot. So that is why in my company, they will always try to recommend you to disengage autopilot at 1,000 feet. Recommend, not enforce, to actually fly manual. So like myself, normally I will disengage around 700 or even 600 feet when I'm on approach to ensure that you still maintain your basics from your flight school on how to fly a plane. So that's why they keep reminding us whenever we fly, don't rely too much on autopilot. Anytime, anything can fail. Even the autopilot can fail on you. So be always alert.
But some airlines nowadays, they emphasize to fly more on automation because it is more safer and stable to fly, like, example, the approach. So they want the pilots to leave it to train and fly on more on autopilot. So, and some airlines, they say, because since a lot of accidents happen during this critical phase of flight, they allow them to, you know, fly more hands-on. But during times where there are less traffic or less congested during the landing phase.
Autopilots are very stable and very safe if the pilots themselves know what is the capability of the pilot. If you don't know the capability of the autopilot, this is what will happen. Basically, what happened to Asiana crew, that is what happened. They over-relied on something that they were thinking would assist. However, it didn't assist. So everything has limitation. Autopilot has their limitation. In other words, if you know your car well, you will know how it reacts. If you know how your autopilot behaves, you will know what to do. So that is why they say over-reliance of autopilot is not good. That is why a place where I'm flying, they mention clearly that, you know, if you want to fly autopilot all the way, feel free as long as you know your autopilot faults and defects. Because if anything happens, you should know what to do.
Okay. But in this situation, yeah, the crew relied too much on automation. I think because the training also told them to, you know, rely mostly on automation. So that's why the crew also just depended on automation all the way. And even on this clear, bright day approach, they still cannot handle the situation. So, yeah. And I think it's also because of CRM that they have three crew in the cockpit. So they should have avoided the crash.
It was a training flight, actually.
Yeah. The training flight. So what do you think, CRM, is it possible that they avoided the crash? I think it's the CRM problem.
The report doesn't say what is the causes of it, but I guess you can put it down to CRM as one of those reasons.
One of the factors.
Yeah, because nobody, you know, monitored the speed, mostly the speed of the aircraft decayed until it stalled and crashed. So
rather than saying it is fault of CRM, I would rather say that it's actually the fault of situation awareness. You are not aware of what is going on. You're too this is where it comes when someone becomes too fixated and too over-reliant on autopilots. So Yeah, if you become fixated, you will lose track on your speed. That is why in every flying, there'll be one pilot monitoring and one pilot flying. So the guy who's flying, he is looking outside and inside, and the pilot monitoring is the pilot who is actually monitoring things that you might have overlooked. So if you're losing on speed, he's supposed to say speed. If at all rate of descent is high, rate of descent. Glide path is not proper, glide slope. You know, these are the things that pilot monitoring should say. Again, this was a training flight. The training captain was on the right-hand seat and the trainee captain was on the left-hand side. So both of them, they were... the captain was concentrating too many things at one time. And coincidentally, if I'm not mistaken, this was actually a VOR approach. So they didn't have proper glide path guidance. They actually had to manually, you know, cross-check the height, landing in, right? So it's very crucial for situational awareness.
Okay, yeah, very true, very true. So last and final incident, the Aero Mexico flight 2431, a Mexican domestic scheduled passenger flight bound for Mexico City that crashed on takeoff from Durango International Airport on July 31st, 2018. So guys, what could have the crew have done to avoid the crash?
First of all, this accident was actually partially caused by a sudden wind shear. You know? So, like you've mentioned, I mean, the plane rapidly lost speed, altitude, and then eventually impacted the runway, causing the engines to detach and also skid about 1,000 feet or 300 meters beyond the runway. So, based on this report, the investigator actually found that the primary cause of the accident was due to the adverse weather conditions encountered by the flight. But there were also other factors contributed to it, which includes crew error, the ATC error, and also the lack of equipment at the airport to actually detect wind shear. These are all part of the investigation report, which, I mean, the investigators concluded. Another thing is that there was an unauthorized student pilot in the cockpit who was actually flying the plane during the takeoff.
Oh, okay, yep, that is a no-no.
Yeah, so it caused also the crew to actually be distracted. Eventually, back again to the main, to the topic, the loss of situation and awareness.
Okay. Like this adverse weather condition, I think it's caused by a microburst. What is a microburst and why do we need to know to avoid the microburst or recover from a microburst?
Microburst is actually a sudden... let me put it to you this way. La. Microburst is actually a localized column of sinking air. Normally occurs within thunderstorms and it lasts from a few seconds to a few minutes actually at times. And it's dangerous for departures and also for arrivals. And why it's very dangerous is, when you're departing, you will be having a sudden headwind. That means you'll be having strong headwinds. The aircraft will lift up very fast. And then suddenly, you won't climb. You will maintain your height or even you lose height because the air is actually pressing your aircraft down. And when you're exiting the microburst, you will have a sudden loss of speed. And important for an aircraft is they need speed. If there's no speed, there's no lift. There's no lift, the aircraft falls. So that is for departure. And as for landings, same. You'll have a sudden strong headwind. So you will tend to reduce your speed. And then suddenly your rate of descent will be increasing very fast. So to counter it, you'll gradually increase your speed again. And then when you're exiting the microburst, you will actually be losing speed. So there are very huge amounts of power play. So it's a standard thumb rule for all crew. If you are aware of a microburst, do not attempt the landing. Just hold for a few minutes and then we land. And if at all you are unexpectedly experiencing it, we have done trainings for this. So it's like always do a go-around procedure. Even if you're departing or you're landing, do a go-around procedure to ensure that, you know, you do not crash.
Okay.
We have this quick reference handbook where there actually is a maneuver section where it actually teaches you what to do when you encounter a wind shear. What are the steps you're supposed to be taking in case of any wind shear? Makers of these airplanes actually improve their manuals in regards to all these encounters to avoid any, you know, accidents from happening.
Mm,
It's part of your training, and it's in your SOP. So it's something like a memo item. However, it's not really an emphasized memo item. So just, try your best. I mean, if someone reports that there's a microburst, do not attempt the departure or arrival. And if you do, maintain your landing gear down, maintain go-down power, and keep your pitching according to your manufacturer or your company's recommendations, and hope for the best and expect the worst. So far, I personally haven't experienced it yet, and I wish not to. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it basically comes down back to basic pitch and power flight.
Yes. Right? Like the error done in this particular case is after airborne crew put the landing gear up. So in our procedures, it's mentioned that if you suspect that you have encountering a microburst, maintain your landing gear down. This is to ensure that if the air pushes down the aircraft so that the aircraft can roll and stop safely, in other words.
Okay. So guys, this is the summary of this episode, which is critical phase of flight, as whereby most accidents occur on takeoff and landings. So we crews will be trained and be ready for any encounters like adverse weather conditions or unsafe criterias on landing or takeoffs, and we will always have safety as our priority. So in other words, a delay is better than a disaster. So do not complain where your flight is delayed or cancelled, because safety is always the airline's top priority. Okay, that's a wrap, guys. Thank you, Boss and Vincent, in joining me in today's Aeronauts podcast. Dear listeners, please give us a like on our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram page. That is AER0NUTS. AER0NUTS, Aeronauts. And hope to see you guys again soon. Bye.
When I think back on these times and the dreams we left behind, I'll be glad 'cause I